Do you remember when our podcast was 10 minutes long?
No.
It never got out of the pilot stage.
The CMU podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, YouTube, not YouTube, and YouTube MP3. It's the CMU podcast, poking, prodding and analysing the last week in the music business for your pleasure. And I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. I have here Chris Cook, the business editor of CMU. Imagine, we're both back. For real, after something of a break. Well, two breaks. We came back and then we had a break.
Well, we had the summer break, but then we felt we needed to come back to just quickly talk through what had happened in the summer.
Yeah.
Otherwise, this podcast would have been way too long. And then we had a little break for reasons I can't quite remember. But now we are back, and we're back every single week from now until the end of time.
Or at least the end of, well, middle of December.
Well, depending on how the American presidential election goes, that could be the end of time.
Yes.
So we'll be here every week, although Nick...
Do you think that if Donald Trump wins, the first thing he'll do would just be launch all the nuclear missiles?
Well, he's not actually in power till January, is he? But who knows?
So we've got till January.
We've got till January.
We may or may not bring the podcast back in January, depending on the existence of the world.
And indeed the universe. Who knows? What could happen? It's all to play for. Although we are back in the weekly format, next week's going to be a sort of special edition of the podcast. So we come back with our sort of slick, slightly tightened up weekly format for the foreseeable future. And then we immediately have a sort of out of the ordinary edition. Because next Thursday, which is the 6th of October, if you're keeping count, which reminds me, it's my mum's birthday on Tuesday. So I must remember to send her some sort of gift.
Right, or send her a copy of the report.
Perhaps I'll send her a pre-release copy of Dissecting the Digital Dollar, Part 2, because that is coming out next Thursday. It's, if you remember, regular listeners of the podcast might recall that late last year, the UK Music Managers Forum put out this thing called Dissecting the Digital Dollar. The aim was to explain once and for all how streaming services of the Spotify variety were licensed by the music publishers and the record companies and the collecting societies, and what happens to the money as it flows through the system, and also to raise some of the issues around the way the streaming music market works. So that came out a year ago, various issues were raised, and then all this year, the MMF has been doing roundtables with artists and songwriters and labels and publishers, lawyers and accountants, and lots and lots and lots of artist managers. And Part 2 basically summarises all of those debates. And on the back of that, the Music Managers Forum is sort of setting some activities and some positioning statements. And that's all coming out next Thursday. This is relevant to me and to you because we at CMU/CMU Insights, the training and consultancy unit of CMU, we're available for hire if you're interested. Check out cmuinsights.com. But we have put together both editions of Dissecting the Digital Dollar. And that's basically all I've been doing since the last podcast is getting Part 2.
Well, and before the last podcast.
Getting Part 2 finished. It comes out next Thursday, so that's very exciting. And on next week's edition, I will talk through some of the key elements of the report for those of you out there who work in music who don't like to read. So it'll sort of be like the audiobook version. I mean,
which is all of us, because we're all in this business for listening.
Exactly. I'm not going to read it from cover to cover, but I will talk through the key issues that are in there. So next week's edition is going to be a little bit different. We're also launching it first thing in the morning. Well, we record this on Thursday, remember, even though we put it out on a Friday. So on the Thursday, we'll be putting it out in the morning. Then there's a social event in the evening. And somewhere in between those two events, we're going to record a podcast. We haven't quite worked out how or where we're going to do that yet.
But it'll be fun finding out.
It'll be fun finding out. So that's next week, and that's why next week will be a little bit out of the ordinary. But other than next week, every Friday morning from now until Donald Trump presses the red button, we will be here. What did you say? I'm now going to reveal that this was written down by reminding people that we're going to be poking, prodding and analysing the last week in the music business for your pleasure.
Yes.
Get it on a t-shirt.
Yeah, well, you can, because I will probably change it next week.
Who knows?
Well, I'll definitely change it next week because it'll be a different edition. 2 weeks' time. It doesn't matter. You don't need to know the admin of the intro to the podcast. Let's just get on with story number one this week, which is YouTube and stuff.
YouTube and stuff.
So YouTube has hired former Warner Music exec Leo Cohen to be its new global head of music, which means that he is going to have the tough job of rebuilding bridges between YouTube and the music industry, which currently thinks that YouTube is public enemy number one.
Evil in the words of Irving Azoff, another American music industry veteran. Yeah, this announcement sort of came out of the blue, although I suppose perhaps not surprising, because the music industry has been ramping up its campaign against YouTube for some time now. We've talked a lot about the campaign around safe harbours and trying to get safe harbour rules rewritten, both in Europe and in the US. Safe harbour being a little copyright technicality that enables YouTube to operate its opt-out rather than opt-in streaming service. And I suppose in the US, where the review of safe harbours began earlier in the year, even though most of the sort of lobbying people I speak to in the record industry on the American side admit it is unlikely that they're going to get US copyright law rewritten on this point, they did stage a very high-profile campaign that involved a lot of mainly older artists, the sort of the young kid artists who built their careers on YouTube, but the aging pop stars who will be given a page in the Washington Post or USA Today to vent. And we had a string of sort of heritage artists slagging off YouTube and basically accusing YouTube of screwing over artists and screwing over songwriters and ruining the music industry. And Irving Azoff, his background is artist management, also had a stint at Live Nation and has been very vocal about YouTube actually for some time, but also sort of orchestrated that side of that campaign and ensured that a campaign which over here has been very much led by the record companies and the music publishers got artists and managers much more involved over in the US. And you sort of feel that YouTube, possibly having seen all of this bad press that has been doing the rounds, are starting to think, we need to do something. We need to do something to shut the music industry up or to find a way of compromising with the music industry that doesn't involve writing a $1 billion check. How do we do that? I know, let's hire one of their own. I suppose in much the same way that, well, Apple, through acquiring Beats, brought Jimmy Iovine in to help oversee its streaming service. Spotify recently, of course, brought in a sort of a veteran of the American music industry. Troy Carter, best known, of course, for his stint of managing Lady Gaga's career. He was sort of been brought in at Spotify to keep all the artists sweet. So it's sort of the way you do it. If you want to keep the music industry sweet, you hire one of the music industry's own, you give them a very senior sounding job, and then you say, hopefully, them and their mates over in the record companies, we can smooth all of this over, get all the labels on side, shut up all those aging artists, and it'll all be fine, and we won't have to write that $1 billion check. Presumably they're writing quite a big check to Leah Cohen.
Yeah, well, now they can't afford to pay the music industry.
But they won't have to write the $1 billion check that really is what the record companies and the music publishers want.
Yeah, so Irving Azoff, who you mentioned there, he's pleased. He said, "We are counting on you, Leah, to lead YouTube to provide fair payments to artists and give them more creative control. Congratulations, Leah. I know you can get it done." Which that puts quite a weight of responsibility on him to start with.
Hey, Leo, go and get it done.
Then YouTube chief business officer, Robert Kinkle, he said, Leo is the lion of the music industry.
I don't know what that means.
I don't know what it means. It sounds good, doesn't it?
Well, does it? Does it sound like he's going to go out and placate people and compromise? Does it just sound like he's going to shout and roar at the music industry until they fall in line?
Well, we'll see, because the other quote we've got is Bob Lefsetz in his Lefsetz letter on this just opened it with the sentence, "The only problem is people hate him." So some different opinions there.
Of Leo Cohen, you mentioned a former Warner Music exec, before that a Universal Music exec, and then involved in the very early days of Def Jam. And since leaving Warner, he has run his own little music company called 300, which is sort of I can't remember how, it was one of those really confusing companies when it launched. It's like, well, are you a label? Are you a management company? I think he kept insisting on calling it a music content company, a boutique music content agency or something like that.
Yeah.
But that's what he's been doing since leaving Warner. Google was an investor in that company. So he left Warner, he went away for about half a year, and then rumours sort of started to circulate. Leo Cohen's coming back for a new business, and then he arrived clearly with a well-financed business, and it subsequently materialised that Google was one of the backers. So I suppose it's perhaps not surprising that if top people at Google/YouTube have decided we now need to sort out this problematic relationship with the music industry, it probably is. He is the most obvious person for them to go to.
And prior to 10 years ago, as a Warner music exec, he was involved in Warner becoming the first major label to sign a licensing deal with YouTube. So his good relations with the company go back a long way. Although he was then later involved in the first big dispute with YouTube.
But, it is true. Warner were the first major, and Leo Cohen on his watch, to sign up to YouTube pre the Google acquisition. So when YouTube was very much still a startup business, and Warner were the first to sort of do a licensing deal and embrace YouTube rather than threatening to try and sue it out of business. Bearing in mind that those were the days where Warner wasn't usually the first to sign on to new digital services. They had a bit of a reputation for being the holdout major. Although having done that deal and then Google bought YouTube, The majors also got equity as part of their deals, so the Google acquisition was a good payday. But Warner was, you're right, one of the first of the big music companies to have a public falling out with YouTube. When that initial deal came up for renewal, there was then a bit of a squabble over the new rates, which resulted in theory, Warner Videos coming down off YouTube for a short period of time. So in his stint at Warner, he was both the guy who oversaw the, we all love YouTube, let's do a deal, and then one of the first, hey YouTube, pay us more money. So he has had both positions in his position as a record label executive. Obviously, YouTube does have its own existing good relationships in the music community, just not at the top of the big record companies and publishers, collecting societies. The old guard of the industry have very much spun YouTube as being enemy number one, as you say. But at a more grassroots level, there are lots of artists for whom YouTube is their primary fan engagement platform, and there are some artists who are now building established careers who do recognise that had they not had YouTube 4, 5, 6 years ago, they wouldn't have got where they are now, and so are more prone to say, okay, we only get a little bit of money off our YouTube channel, but that's better than nothing, and without YouTube, we wouldn't have built the fan base, we wouldn't have been able to do all the other deals, and so actually we quite like YouTube. So YouTube does have some good relationships within the music industry, but not at the top. And presumably that will be the brief for Leo Cohen on day number one, is go and get all the big, influential industry people and artists who have been dissing YouTube now relentlessly for the last year. Go and get them and get them on side somehow.
Yes. And well, as you said earlier, the record industry and the publishing industry have been really ramping up their battle against YouTube in the last 9 months, a year or so. More than that, probably now. This month, they had something of a sort of almost win.
Well, it's hard to know.
It's hard to know, isn't it?
So we're going back to the safe harbours point.
Well, all we know is Google wasn't happy about
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
So it sort of suggested it was a win.
that was the main reason why the music industry could smile, the fact that Google were clearly a little bit down on that. So this is the safe harbours review, but not in the US, because as I say, when I talk to them off the record, most of the lobbyists working for the music industry will admit, not on the record, but off the record, it is unlikely that they're going to get a change to the safe harbour rules in the US. The review that's going on there, as it is a Copyright Office review, not a congressional review. It's not even in Congress yet. Whereas in Europe, there has been a complete review of copyright in the online age as part of the Digital Single Market Initiative. And earlier this month, the European Commission put out its draft new copyright directive, which covers a number of different things, because basically this review has been looking at all sorts of things. But down the bottom of the draft directive, there are a few points which are specifically aimed at the music community, one of which is a really wishy-washy, vague, ambiguous attempt to try and deal with the record industry and the music publishers' issue with the safe harbour, and in particular the way YouTube and others, but mainly YouTube. The way YouTube uses that safe harbour to have a sort of specific business model that the music industry doesn't like. And so it was an achievement that it was even in there, because with the early sort of publications that came out from the review of copyright in the digital age from the European Commission didn't even really put it on the agenda. It was a real sort of afterthought down the bottom, whereas there is a specific article of the draft copyright directive which is attempting to put more obligations on user upload platforms. The challenge is the safe harbours exist originally so that internet service providers and server hosting companies and companies like that can't be held liable if their customers use their internet access or their server space to infringe copyright. And that's why the safe harbour exists. And so the challenge is, even if you think that websites like YouTube shouldn't enjoy those safe harbours, how do you, without writing YouTube, because you can't write YouTube into the directive, how do you describe that sort of platform so you have an effect on the sorts of platforms you want to stop using the safe harbour without affecting everybody else? And so they talked about there being lots of content, so it would have to be an established website, it wouldn't affect every little startup. And they talked about users uploading content and that content then being publicly accessible. So there was various different ways that they were trying to define a YouTube-type site. And then they said these sites would have some extra obligations beyond the basic obligations that come with the safe harbour. And as you say, Google didn't immediately say, oh, we love this article. They said, oh, this is a bit concerning. So that suggests that they see it as potentially putting some new obligations on YouTube. Although I have to say, the way I read it as it is currently drafted, it is just a draft. This has to go before the European Parliament. It has to go before the Council of the European Union. So there's plenty of chances for it to be rewritten as yet. And then once the directive is passed in Europe, it then has to be implemented on a national level in each country. So none of this is going to happen overnight, and it could change quite significantly as yet. But as it is currently written, there's a couple of words in there which I can see are why YouTube are nervous. But it's almost written in a way that YouTube, when the directive gets passed, will probably be able to say, we think we're already compliant with this, as it is. It talks a lot about having content ID type systems, about seeking to get licensing deals from copyright owners, and then providing tools to help those licenses work. Well, YouTube would say, well, we've already done all of that. We did all of that voluntarily. So we're already compliant with this new directive. So we'll see where it goes. But the fact that Google did express concern suggests that they don't see it as a complete success in Europe as yet. Who knows what will happen, let alone what will happen here. Will we even be in the European Union by the time this directive comes into effect? But it is still on the agenda. It is still to be negotiated on both sides. But perhaps YouTube are hoping that with Leah Cohen in the house, all of this will just go away.
It'll go away.
They'll just back down. It doesn't matter. We're very happy with YouTube. And good old Leah.
And in a year's time, we'll all wonder, what was the fuss about? That's what we'll all wonder. What was the fuss about? You know what we should really be worrying about? It's not YouTube. It's YouTube MP3.
Yes.
More of which later.
Yes.
But that's all we've got to say about YouTube for now. Given the intro you gave at the top of this podcast, given we've already covered YouTube, I suggest that we have a jingle and then we cover not YouTube.
Yeah, this section is not YouTube. It's rumours about all of the other services.
It's every other streaming service you can think of that's not YouTube.
Who they're buying, who they're not buying, who's buying them, and who says that's not happening or is happening. Basically, rumours of streaming services being bought are nothing new, but there have been a lot of them popping up again lately.
And some of these from the last 7 days, although we are technically going beyond our brief here, because some of these are from the last month, basically since we last did a podcast. But you're right. Although there are constantly rumours that this company is going to buy this streaming service or this streaming service is going to buy this company, there have been quite a few of late. And I suppose as we put the podcast together, if we start with the most recent, the rumour that broke, so this morning as we record this, yesterday, if you're listening to it, as the podcast goes out, recently, if you take a while to get round to listening to this podcast, basically the Financial Times reckons that Spotify is back in talks to buy SoundCloud and that they are in advanced negotiations that could as yet fail. So that's
so that's fun.
Something to look.
So they may or
to.
May not be buying SoundCloud, and neither Spotify nor SoundCloud will confirm or deny the validity of that talk. So that's good. That's
so
fun.
That's a good rumor.
But the Financial Times tend not to just throw things around.
Usually a reliable source. So I do believe that we have said on this podcast several times this year that this is something of a make or break year for good old SoundCloud. Obviously, they announced their licenses with the majors and the indies. They slowly announced those over a couple of years, didn't they? But they had everything in place earlier this year. And on the back of that, they launched the premium service, SoundCloud Go. So SoundCloud Go went live. I don't know which countries it's live in now. It's live here, isn't it, in the UK?
Yes.
Live in the UK, everybody. And of course, the ad-funded thing that they've been piloting in America for a couple of years, they've started to roll that out now as well. So after a couple of years of having these ideas that, oh, we're going to go into advertising, we're going to go into premium, but taking a while to convince Universal, and then Sony was the real holdout, wasn't it? And then obviously they almost went to court with PRS, but then eventually they managed to do a deal with PRS on the publishing side here in the UK. So they've got those deals sort of in place. They've got these new products on market. They have on the quiet raised some new finance, which is how they have afforded to do those deals and settle that PRS litigation. But it sort of feels that even if you think that the current SoundCloud model of we've got the free as normal and then we'll upsell premium and where we can't do that, we'll sell it. Even if you think that that is a goer, and actually I'm not convinced it is, but even if you do think that that's a goer, there is an element that it sort of, I don't know, you feel it sort of took SoundCloud 5 years too long to work out that that's what they were going to be.
Well, the problem was, I think, that SoundCloud had been wanting to sell for a while. and they were trying to sell as they were, and then it just became apparent that actually the lack of licenses and possibility of legal action was a real off-putting thing for buyers spending upwards of $500 million on something.
Yes, so, who wants to buy a company that might immediately result in having to be involved in a whole load of
lawsuits.
So then
they were like, oh, we're going to have to sort all this out, and then that took 3 years, and as you say, now it's sort of it's all a little bit too late, but maybe Spotify will still buy it, so maybe they can still offload it.
And it sort of is at the point, as you say, I think the most recent valuation was 700 million, and I've seen valuations higher than that, which is, in my humble opinion,
I think they've gone up to 2 billion, which is ridiculous.
In my opinion, even at 500 million, which is sort of at the lower end of valuations, I mean, it's basically an overvalued company. It's a startup that took too long to gain momentum, took too much investment. It's now an overvalued company. And you're sort of at the point of, as you say, we've been saying for a number of years now, SoundCloud really needs a buyer. Once those licensing things were sorted out, it's like, yeah, now it really needs a buyer. But you're sort of at the point of, well, who would buy it? And obviously Twitter have expressed an interest in the past and have been linked again more recently. There is a logic to Spotify. Some people might say, well, why would Spotify need SoundCloud? They've already got the audience. They've already got the content. I mean, obviously there is some content on SoundCloud that Spotify don't have, but Spotify does now have the CMU podcast, and obviously that would be the main thing that it would be looking for from SoundCloud. So why would Spotify want SoundCloud? And Spotify has, I mean, they're both loss-making companies, but Spotify is signing up lots of premium users. We've not had any figures from SoundCloud on the success of SoundCloud Go to date, but
well, it's early days, isn't it?
It's early days, but you have to think if there was a really surprising, impressive sign-up rate, we would have heard about it. So why would Spotify want SoundCloud? I think there is a little bit of logic to Spotify buying SoundCloud, not a half opinion. But obviously, the way Spotify has grown its premium subscriber base, and obviously it now has by far the biggest premium subscriber base in the streaming music market, and the way it's done that is by hooking people in for a free service and then trying to desperately upsell them to the $10, €10, £10 a month service. That's Spotify's model. So unlike their big competitors, obviously Apple already has the iTunes audience to try and sell Apple Music to. Everybody who buys an iPhone, they try and push Apple Music on them. You were saying that you were pleased that with the recent iOS upgrade, you managed to delete the Apple Music app from your phone entirely.
Yeah, don't need it.
You don't need it. But that is, Apple have that advantage that they have an audience they can push to. Amazon, we know, are pushing into streaming in various different ways beyond the music element of Amazon Prime, and they already have a massive audience that they can sell to. Google, YouTube have a massive audience they can sell to. Spotify have managed to grow their audience by basically offering a great free service and then upselling. And I suppose by buying SoundCloud, they would get overnight a massive new free crowd, freemium crowd, if you like, to try and sell premium to. Now, there would be quite a lot of crossover between SoundCloud and Spotify's user base.
Yeah.
But there would also be, you know, a big audience who are not currently Spotify users on either free or paid for, who they could now try and sell the Spotify premium service to. So that's one of the things that they would get by acquiring SoundCloud. The other thing they might have, which is a sort of conspiracy theory on my part, I think I said this about a year ago when Pop, when a Dissecting Digital Dollar came out, is I sort of feel that once Spotify reach a certain point with their premium service, Spotify Free becomes a bit of a pain. We know that the bosses of certainly some of the major record companies now don't really like Spotify Free anymore. They sort of still accept that it has a role to play in upselling premium, but they don't like the fact that Spotify Free is so similar to Spotify Premium. They would like Spotify Free to be really stripped back, and Spotify in the main have been resisting that. But Spotify, I think, itself will reach a point where, I mean, Spotify Free loses everybody money. Everybody loses a lot of money on Spotify Free. Spotify does, the labels do. Well, they lose money, but they make a lot less money. So everybody's subsidizing free. I think there might be a point at which Spotify goes, do you know what? We no longer need our free service to continue growing our business. But it's a real PR challenge to shut it down. So what if we have SoundCloud over here? And so we can say, okay, from this point onwards, Spotify is our paid-for service, SoundCloud is our free service, and we'll sort out some more preferential licensing rates because we will convince the labels that SoundCloud now is a sort of slightly less user-friendly discovery platform through which we will upsell premium. Perhaps that could all work.
Perhaps.
Although I still don't think it's worth half a bit. Half a billion. And I presumably Spotify...
Well, if that is the plan, that's a risk, because there's no guarantee that any of that would pay off.
Well, and one would assume, even at 500 million, Spotify couldn't afford to buy SoundCloud in a cash deal, so it would have to be predominantly some sort of equity exchange, so mash the two companies together ahead of IPO. So who knows? But advanced talks that could as yet fall through.
I'll tell you what, there is one way that Spotify could afford to buy SoundCloud for cash, and that would be if it in turn was bought by Facebook.
It's true.
Because that's the other rumour.
It is. Now, this is less of a rumour and more of a sort of a musing by a investment chap who has some money in Spotify.
Yeah, so an analyst from GP Bullhound, which is a British investment firm that has some money in Spotify. This guy, Joachim Dahl, he did an interview where he said that he still thought that an IPO for Spotify was the most likely outcome.
And next year we're expecting that now.
But you shouldn't rule out the possibility of Facebook swooping in and just buying it. And his main reasoning for that seemed to be that Daniel Ek and Mark Zuckerberg are friends, and Facebook has developed services other than music, so music would probably be next. I mean, it's not a very strong argument.
Of course, I mean, Facebook and Spotify have had a long-standing close partnership. And do you remember there was that press conference where Facebook added frictionless? It's the only word I can remember from that press conference.
Frictionless sharing.
Exactly. And it was very much, okay, you listen to your music on Spotify, but then you share it on Facebook and we're gonna integrate. And that was very buzzy for a while. And on the back of that, there was speculation of...
Well, it was buzzy until it actually happened. And then, because frictionless sharing was just like, everything you do will automatically share things on Facebook. You don't have to post a status on Facebook again. And it turned out that was really annoying. So that didn't work.
It didn't really work. But there was, round about that time, and also... They had Sean Parker in common, didn't they? He was an advisor or an investor or something at both the companies. Obviously, Sean Parker also being involved way back in the day in the original Napster. So Facebook and Spotify have had a relatively close partnership over the years. But I think it was a little bit of wild speculation by this guy. Although, since that interview was given, we have heard that Facebook is now hiring a music licensing, I can't remember the exact job title, a global head of music licensing
something like that,
which suggests they have some new ambitions in music. Again, there has been speculation for years now that Facebook is going to launch a proper music service, and it never really has. My gut instinct of that is more about trying to sort out some YouTube-style deals, because obviously for Facebook video, because Facebook video is just growing and growing now. More and more music content is appearing, whether it's little snippets of music videos or music synced into other people's videos. And that's a licensing disaster waiting to happen. And we know things are happening behind the scenes already on that. But I would suspect that that is more what that's about, rather than Facebook going into the full-on audio streaming business. But if it was wanting to do that, well, buying Spotify would be an easy way of doing it.
The other bit of news on acquisitions is the death of a rumour. Apple is not buying Tidal. Jimmy Iovine says so. It probably means that Apple is buying Tidal.
Various rumours this year, of course, that Apple were thinking of buying Tidal. Again, that's another one where it's like, well, why? Why would they want to? I mean, Apple Music is already way ahead of Tidal, even though obviously Tidal in its pre-Jay-Z incarnation has been around a lot longer than Apple Music. So why would they want to buy it? Although, I suppose just the press conference of Dre and Jay-Z shaking hands would be good. We all know Apple like a good press conference.
Yeah.
And it would get them access. I mean, another thing...
Although, if you look at Tidal's history, they're not good at press conferences.
No. But Apple are good at press conferences. So providing it was Apple's PR people who were doing the press conference, that would be a good photo shoot. And also, obviously, Apple Music have been big on artist exclusives recently. We then had that pushback from Universal Music sort of being officially down on exclusives, and various other people coming along and saying, yeah, all these artist exclusives, tying albums to streaming services, stop doing that. But we know that Apple still want to pursue that strategy to grow their audience. Tidal have done that as well. And having access to Jay-Z and Roc Nation and all the various artists that he works with who have been predominantly giving their exclusives to Tidal to date, it would unlock a whole load of extra exclusive content. And I don't actually know how much they would want for Tidal. I have to think that in Apple terms, it would be a pittance.
Yeah.
It would be a sizable sum of money. But in the context of Apple's stack of cash, it would be like lunch to acquire Tidal. And there would be that artist access and the PR coup. So I could sort of see why that would work for Apple. I can definitely see why it would work for Tidal. for Tidal.
Yeah.
But official line is it's not happening. So normally when we get an official line like that, I would expect to be back in a week's time announcing Apple's acquisition of Tidal. But who knows? We'll see. Is that all the rumours we've got?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Well, we should stop wildly speculating and spreading unsubstantiated rumour.
So some stories in brief now from the last week or so. Let's start with Pandora, which has relaunched its premium personalised radio service. Not quite yet launched its on-demand service, so it did confirm that an on-demand service is coming.
And that it's got its deals now with all of the majors and the indies to allow that fully on-demand service. But yes, yeah, so fully on-demand Pandora service coming this year, they're still saying, so before Christmas. So Pandora moving into Spotify, Apple Music territory. But in the meantime, if you want to give Pandora money, you don't have to wait for the fully on-demand service, because Pandora already have a premium service. It's just that no one knows about it. But now they're hoping that more people will know about it. $5 a month. Obviously, Pandora only really available in the US and Australia and New Zealand. Plans to grow. But at the moment, you can get the $5 a month, and they're sort of ramping it up, a bit of extra functionality, hyping it up more to try and have a sort of a middle market product as well as that full, basically, Spotify, Apple Music identical service that will come online later this year.
Yeah, and it was a bit of a preemptive strike, the announcement, which came slightly earlier than they would have wanted, I think, because they didn't actually have a deal done with Warner Music at the point they announced. But a few days later, iHeartRadio announced basically the same thing.
Yeah, iHeart being the main competitor of Pandora in the US, the iHeart company, formerly Clear Channel, being the biggest AM/FM radio station company in America, but iHeart Radio is their Pandora ripoff, basically does pretty much the same thing. And you're right, they had one of their festivals, one of their iHeart festivals, they used that to announce, we're launching subscription paid for, because they've never had a paid for option before. It's all been free ad funded to date. And they are coming to market with a $5 a month enhanced personalised radio experience and a fully on-demand $10 a month experience as of next January. So yes, you sense that that was why Pandora sort of rushed their announcements when they weren't really quite ready. iHeart would like it to be known that although it sounds very much like they're doing exactly what Pandora are doing, they're also going to integrate live radio into the experience. So it's not the same at all.
Oh,
it's
right.
Totally different. So lots of things happening over there. Pandora definitely ambitions, well, they've always had ambitions to come over here, but very much it's on their agenda now. So Pandora should be spreading around the rest of the world in the relatively near future. It's as yet unclear whether iHeart likewise have ambitions to come over here, although they also now have direct deals with the labels rather than relying on the compulsory license in the US through Sound Exchange, which I would assume would make it easier for them to come over here if they wanted to.
Getting off digital music for 2 seconds and into live, Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, announced this week that he's planning to introduce the Agent of Change principle to London.
As part of his London plan, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
So this is a move to try and help the grassroots music community. We've talked about Agent of Change before.
We have.
Because, I can't remember why.
I think we've talked about it more than once. It came up at the Great Escape.
It did come up at the Great Escape. Remind us what the Agent of Change principle is.
Basically means that if you're a property developer and you build a load of flats next to a noisy venue that's
on
top of a noisy venue that's pre-existing, it is your responsibility to sort out the soundproofing and everything so that the people in the flats don't get annoyed by the noisy venue. Whereas generally what happens is someone starts up a venue, it makes a bit of town cool, and then property developers come in and go, oh, let's build flats in this cool bit of town, and then put out of business all the things that make it cool.
Yeah, because all the people who can afford to buy these really expensive properties that are built then start complaining to the council about the noise. And you might remember Ministry of Sound had a run-in with a property developer a few years ago now. And this is sort of when it really first came to my attention that this was even a thing, because it does seem mad. It's sort of like, well, I can understand why if someone sets up a noisy music venue next to where you live, that's annoying and there should be ways that you can try and stop that or force soundproofing. But if you choose to move in next to an existing venue, how can you then complain about the noise? But through the ministry story, I learned that's a thing, that venues can get shut down because new neighbours complain to the council, get the terms of the licence changed. The venue is then told you've got to spend $200,000 on a new soundproofing system. No grassroots venue, or even a venue like the Ministry of Sound, could afford to do that, and they go out of business. And we've subsequently had venues elsewhere in the country where they have been brought to the brink of going out of business because of this. So yes, this agent of change principle, which I think we're stealing from Australia. I think some of the, I don't know if it's Australia-wide or certain parts of Australia have this system. So the London mayor is going to try and make it the norm across London. Although we hear that it is a condition that is already being added to planning permission in Westminster Council, which is good news for the fans of art house cinema.
Yeah, because actually this all came up because the Curzon Mayfair, which is a very old cinema.
And I think it's on Curzon Street, which makes me assume it's the original Curzon. Obviously, there are now loads of Curzon
cinemas. It was a purpose-built... Yes, the original Curzon cinema was purpose-built to be a cinema. It's over 100 years old, I think. And it had offices above it. So obviously, there was never any problem. But those offices are now being turned into flats.
Which in Mayfair will be...
Which will be
pretty damn expensive.
Yes. And the developer there is saying, well, your cinema is going to annoy the people in these flats, so you're going to have to soundproof. And the cinema went, wait, what? For one thing, the cinema is listed, so it's not as easy as just sticking in some soundproofing. But they're like, we've been here for a really long time without any issue. Surely this is not our responsibility. And apparently, actually, the council did write the agent of change principle into its contract with the developer, so it is going to be the developer's responsibility, although there has been some dispute over this and court action.
Yeah, but hopefully, if I don't quite know what is required in order to get this actually properly into planning law, but it seems to me like, well, it's one of those things where when you first come across this, it's like, well, surely that's already the how is that not already the way it works? So hopefully we can get it working that way in London and then spread it out everywhere else in the UK. Back to digital.
Yeah, mega upload stuff's been happening with that.
But
no one's been extradited.
Not as yet.
For nearly 5 years
we
since mega upload was taken offline and extradition proceedings were begun against its executives, including Kim.com. They've just had... Is it the first appeal?
It's the first appeal. So
the US... first appeal of probably many.
The US are trying to get Kim.com and his former colleagues from the often controversial file transfer platform Mega Upload. Let's all have a quick replay of the Mega song in our heads here. Yeah, Mega, Mega Upload. So the US want to get those execs, including Kim.com, into America so they can face charges of money laundering, racketeering. Do you know, I've been covering this story for 4.5 years now. I still don't really know what racketeering is. But they're accused of it. And, of course, criminal copyright infringement. But they have to get them to the US to face those charges. So the extradition case took forever to get to court. Finally went to court last year. Judge said, yep, we will extradite these guys. They're now appealing it. So the appeal's been ongoing for about a month now. The closing arguments were given this week, although there is still apparently some technicalities to be ironed out. Don't quite know what those are. So it's probably going to be at least a couple more weeks before we get a ruling on this. And whichever way that ruling goes, either the US government if they lose or the Mega Upload execs if they lose, they have another route of appeal. They will absolutely go on the next stage of appeal. So who knows where we'll be. There probably won't be an internet by the time the US government does or does not get Kim.com to an American courtroom. But it's a safe harbours case. If it ever gets to court, this will be another test of safe harbours and the American safe harbours, which probably the music industry are not going to get reformed anytime soon.
There's also another Mega Upload appeal ongoing, which is Kim.com trying to get his assets back from the US government.
Yes, which were seized back
in
2012.
That's another one that's been rolling on for a long time.
And this is... well, it's an attempt to get a rehearing. So technically, it's not a true appeal. So the American government seized all his stuff. They've given him some of the money back to fund the defence in New Zealand, but most of it they're still hanging on to. And Kim.com's lawyers went to court and various arguments said, you've no right to hold on to this money. And a court said, yes, we do. And then the appeals court said, yeah, we do. And now they want the appeals court to have a second think. And then if that doesn't happen, it will go to another appeal court and ultimately all the way up to Supreme Court. So, yeah. Lots of Mega Upload nonsense ongoing.
Robbie Williams is back. He will release his first album for Sony Music in November.
And he used his Apple Music Festival. That doesn't work in the same way as the iTunes Festival, does it? Somehow. It doesn't roll off the Apple Music Festival. They need to find a better name for that. Why don't they call it the Beats Festival? The Beats One Festival. That would be better, wouldn't it?
Would it?
I don't know. So he did a gig at the Apple Music thing at the Roundhouse, and he used that to say, I've got a new record, and it's coming out. What's it called?
The Heavy Entertainment Show.
That's right. It's a play on light entertainment, isn't it?
Yes. And it's got songs written by or with Guy Chambers, who he's made up with, John Grant, Rufus Wainwright, Brandon Flowers, Ed Sheeran and Stuart Price.
Ed Sheeran in there.
Ed Sheeran in
Everyone
there.
Wants an Ed Sheeran track
well,
these
yeah,
days.
Apparently the Ed Sheeran track was a bit of a last-minute addition when Robbie panicked that he didn't have enough hits on the album. So he barely didn't really know Ed Sheeran, but he had his email address and just emailed him and said, have you got any hits I could have? And Ed sent him one back, which is weird, isn't it?
Goes the story according to The Sun. He then added his own chorus, I think,
yeah.
Robbie, making
yeah,
sure he
got... Yeah, because Ed Sheeran, he can't write choruses.
Well, also, Robbie presumably wants his PRS money. So always add a few lines to get your publishing. That's the first rule of being a pop star.
But it turned out that Ed Sheeran just had a hit lying around that he'd give to Robbie. And I'll tell you another thing he's got lying around is a statue of himself as a pig.
So let's hope that Robbie track is a hit. Ed gets lots of publishing because he spent quite a lot of money on this statue pig that almost looks like Ed Sheeran.
I mean, he spent £6,200 on it, which I don't think is a lot of money for Ed Sheeran.
For Ed Sheeran, no, that's sort of breakfast.
And it all goes to a hospice in Ipswich, so that's good.
So this was some art project where they dressed up pigs to look like famous people.
Well, they made statues of pigs that looked like famous people. They didn't dress up any actual pigs.
No, all right then. And then they auctioned them all off. And then we heard that the Ed Sheeran one had made way more money than all the rest at £6,000. And then it subsequently materialised. That's because Ed himself bid for the pig that he is now going to put in his house somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, you would, wouldn't you?
You would. You would.
Someone made a pig statue of you.
Would you?
Yeah, I think so.
Would you?
Well, I mean...
Did you see the pig statue?
Not any pig statue, but, you know, I don't start making pig statues of me and expecting me to buy them. I want to state that now.
I will.
But, you know, I will assess them on their merits.
I am going to make a pig statue of Andy Moulton in the next week. And then I'm going to bring it with me, not next week, because we'll be in the middle of dissecting digital dollar stuff, in 2 weeks' time, and I'm going to make you bid on it.
What, against myself?
Against yourself. So that's something to look forward to on future editions of the podcast. If you play the jingle, before we do the last story, I've got a present for you. But it's not a pig. So that's the jingle. I've got Andy Moulton present here. I brought him a bag of Haribo that probably does have pig in it because as any one member of the Smiths will tell you, sweeties often have gelatine in them, which often comes from ground up pigs.
Yeah.
So there probably is some pig in this.
Yeah.
It's a bag of Haribo, which I know is not very exciting. It's only exciting because I discovered at my local pound shop that there is a special version of Haribo called Frenzy Carnival in which nothing tastes like it should. Including
Frenzy
the cola
Carnival.
Bottles. The cola bottles taste like... I can't remember what they taste like. I remember that the blue gummy bears are banana-flavoured. And I mean, that's just crazy,
Look,
it?
It's all on the back. The purple gummy bears are lime. It's blowing my mind.
What are
mind.
The cola bottles?
Grapefruit and pineapple.
There you go. They're cola bottles, but they taste of grapefruit and pineapple.
The eggs are mango.
Everything is mad in this bag of Haribo.
Well,
and us having discussed that the other day...
I didn't bring any lunch with me, so I'll enjoy this after we've recorded this.
I thought I would bring you a little present to
Thank you very much.
Welcome us back to this edition of the podcast.
Well, we'll have those after we've discussed...
The final story.
YouTubeMP3.org. Yes.
Stream ripping.
Yes.
Stream ripping is now the enemy. Do you remember how the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, the IFPI...
Mm-hmm.
was going after, well, what I call VKontakte. You insist on calling it Contact.
Contactor,
the Russian social network, because it was the really bad piracy site. But then all the record companies settled with Contactor, so we can't call them top piracy site anymore. So now we're going after stream ripping, those sites where you go along and you say to it, see this video on YouTube, give me the audio as an MP3. You press a button, it downloads the MP3. It is sort of amazing that these haven't been sued before.
Yeah.
If you go to youtube-mp3.org, which you must not.
Do not do that.
But I did to test, to see how it worked. Because although I was vaguely aware of it being the biggest of these stream ripping sites, as an honest person, I'd never used it before. But I went to test to see just how simple it was. I downloaded the Wolfman Pete Doherty track For Lovers. because I bought that track, and then you know how sometimes Apple just wipes your your MP3? Well, that was one of the ones at some point it wiped. So I felt that I was justified to rip the audio off that track because I did actually once buy that track. And I just wanted
It doesn't matter.
I wanted to test if it worked. It's amazingly easy. You put the YouTube URL and you press a button. Bam, you've got the track as an MP3.
But don't do that.
Utter copyright infringement. Not quite sure it's taken this long to sue them. So the Recording Industry Association of America have already gone legal in the California courts against both the website and its main operator. The site's based in Germany, I think.
The BPI has put it on notification of potential legal action.
Yes, stop or we'll sue, is what the UK Record Industry Trade Body has said. So we'll see what happens. But in the statements put out by both BPI and RIAA and the IFPI, and there were some other quotes on that press release which I didn't even get to read because I got bored. Also, I wanted to go and listen to Wolfman and Pete Doherty pull up because I really like that track.
And you've been denied it.
And I've been denied it for a couple of years by Apple. There was clearly in the statements that they issued, they were saying, we're going to sue this site because it's the biggest of the stream-ripping sites. But hey, Google. They didn't actually say Google, but they meant it. Hey, Google. Why are you letting this site come so high up in your search engine? And hey, Apple, why are you letting other stream raping apps appear in the Apple store? And hey, advertisers, why are you allowing your banner ads to appear on these websites? All of you, you need to sort that out. I'm paraphrasing ever so slightly, but that was sort of what the various trade bodies were saying as they launched this litigation.
I mean, it is true, there are various stream ripping apps in the App Store, which I did some research on them a few years ago. I downloaded like all of them and tried them out, and they were rubbish, and some of them didn't work at all. So that was why no one's really bothered going after them before. But this one is just, and various other like online ones are a lot more user friendly. Google has tried to stop this site before. Google does have a problem with it. In 2012, they blocked access to its servers, and somehow it managed to argue to get access to them again and got back online, back up and running. And the guy who set it up argued that this was a David versus Goliath fight. He was just a little guy. He was a student at the time who just set this thing up. It was perfectly legal in some territories, so you couldn't just block access of it. Yeah, he was a computer science student, not a legal student. But, you know, he's managed to get it back up and running. But BPI's Jeff Taylor argued that this guy, rather than being, just a little guy in his bedroom, he's been making millions off of banner advertising on this site.
It's actually selling a lot of banner ads, spent that much money. But a lot of people are probably using it a lot of times. When I used it to test, I deleted the track afterwards because, you know, that would be dishonest to keep that track. I'll go back to Apple to get my original version. But the banner ad that came up, somewhat ironically, was for London Metropolitan University, which is where I did my law degree. And on the back of that law degree, I would say that in most jurisdictions that aren't a bit rubbish intellectual property, that's quite clearly copyright infringement. But anyway, stream ripping is now enemy number one. Put it at the top of your piracy gripe list and let's see what happens, whether or not they will get YouTube-mp3.org offline. I need it off the airwaves then, but it's not on the airwaves.
No, it's not.
Off the line.
Tell you who is off the airwaves.
Us.
Yes, because that's the end.
End of the podcast.
Yes, that is it for this week.
But if you've had enough of chatting, but would like to listen to some music, you've got a suggestion.
Yeah, why don't you go on Spotify and listen to some of our playlists? We've got playlists. You can listen to them. We're CMUHQ on Spotify if you want to search for us. We've got a weekly playlist of all the music we've covered in the CMU Daily that week, or you can listen to almost all of the music that we've featured in the CMU Approved column in the last year.
And in the last week, that has included...
Oh, who's that included? Debs, Cherry Aids and Scott. So those are some of the new ones on that list.
From all of them. Do you know, I've never listened to a CMU playlist on Spotify. So this week, I'm going to go and listen to both the weekly playlist and the approved playlist. And then I'm going to tell you what I think next week.
Cool.
CMU HQ on Spotify.
You should probably like and subscribe, but no one ever actually does that when someone says it at the end of a podcast. So instead, I think you should write the CMU podcast rocks with a Z on a toilet wall. And that can be your homework for this week. The CMU podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, you can go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7Digital.
But this one, as you say, YouTube MP.
Wow.
I should eat some of these, however.